Welcome to Las Vegas Sun Politics on KUNV. I'm Michael Squires, politics editor at the Sun. Clark County officials have been at odds with the fire union, but now are trying to revive their reputation. We'll explain why. Congresswoman Shelley Berkley is running for Senate and will have to deal with an ethics cloud. But first, the United States Supreme Court is hearing arguments over the constitutionality of the federal health care law. Joining us from Washington is Karen Demergen. Karen, welcome. Before we get into the details of what's being debated, this law, like little else coming out of Congress, has polarized the public. What's the scene like there?
Well, it's what you'd imagine, basically. I mean, this is all coming down to 3 days of argument, and there's three rather nice days in D.C., so you have throngs of people. Started off a few dozen in the morning, it grew to a few hundred by the time the Supreme Court's morning argument session broke up, of people protesting and counter-protesting, and it depends on what time of day it is, who's starting and who's answering. But you've got Tea Partiers out in full force, you've got women's health advocates that sent out people in droves, you have people in doctors' lab coats representing both sides, lots of signs, lots of shouting, lots of megaphones, and lots of demonstrations that at this point, it comes down to nine people who are supposed to be tuning out all of this political discussion. But, of course, everyone's wondering if, their political sympathies of the justices in the court will end up affecting the way they think about this law, the way it seems to have affected everybody else in the country.
Well, Tuesday, the justices got to the heart of the issue, whether the government can, as the law demands, require citizens to buy health insurance. How did those arguments go?
Well, the arguments that they had in the court today was about the health care mandate, and the justices were very, very skeptical sounding of a lot of the points of the government's health care law. And, there's nine justices, right? They can lose four. The government can lose four of the more conservative justices. So it wasn't a surprise when, certain justices were asking, can Congress make commerce in order to regulate it? Basically questioning the idea of, if they could even start this health care mandate that requires people to have health insurance. But where people are getting very nervous about it, or the government must be wringing its hands a little bit, is that Anthony Kennedy, who has become the swing vote judge on the bench, really, said in court today that the health care law changes the relationship of the federal government to the individual in a very fundamental way. And that really is a part of the argument that the 26 states, including Nevada, have been making, bringing this suit, which is that this impinges on freedom. You can't require, as the federal government, you cannot require individuals to purchase something that they weren't already going to purchase. And they're saying that, people were not going to buy health care that the government's making them buy. The government's saying, actually, everyone ends up using health care at some point. Thus, the economy of health care already exists. We're just trying to regulate it the way the Constitution lets us. But when the swing judge, in addition to the conservative justices, starts to, try to poke holes in that, which is their job. That's what they do. That's why they have these oral arguments. But with as much skepticism as seemed to be there today, that, has made the states that are suing feel very, very confident about their position, and they were glowing about that after the argument.
Now, I want to come back to what you said, whether the law requires states to make commerce in order to mandate it. You wrote a really interesting piece over the weekend kind of talking about some of the case law that the justices will look at and kind of laid it out in clear terms. Can you talk about some of those cases and how those have been read by the court and how they could be read this time?
Yeah, sure. I mean, at the heart of this issue is whether healthcare counts as interstate commerce, because under the Constitution, the government has the right to regulate commerce that happens between the states. It's no longer a states' rights issue if you can cross state lines. So what the government is trying to argue is that, yes, it is, and they're hearkening back to precedents that include basically, there's two big decisions. One was about wheat farming, and another one was about growing pot in California. So how does this liken to health care? Well, in those past decisions, the court had said that the government could come in and could regulate what people were doing, even though they weren't necessarily trying to sell their wheat or sell their pot. The fact that they were making waves by growing that stuff in a market that exists means they were affecting the interstate market, and thus the government could come in and regulate the individual and their individual activity. The government saying that's just like what's happening with healthcare right now. People have to buy healthcare. Sickness moves across state lines. People move across state lines. Healthcare is a interstate sort of a commerce issue, and that's why we can regulate it. But, of course, on the other side, you've got the states for suing are saying, no. You can regulate something like wheat. You can regulate something like pot. If I'm growing it, fine. Then, and it's already a substance that's on the market, fine. You can tell me stop doing that. What you can't tell me is to start doing that, which is what they're saying this government mandate is, a mandate that says you must go and buy health insurance from a private insurer if you're not below a certain income level. And that's where they're saying that's compulsion. That's has nothing to do with interstate commerce. That's forcing people to do something that they don't want to do, and that's a freedom issue.
So you say it looks like Kennedy is shaping up to be the swing vote on this. Were there any tells, as they say, in the poker world from some of the justices indicating how the vote might come down?
Well, I mean, look, it is their job to question both sides, you know, very, very sternly. And they did. I mean, the government spoke first, and then the justices did end up grilling the suing states very harshly, too. I mean, John Roberts is the Chief Justice. He was appointed by George Bush, right, who very much asked the government questions. It sounded like he was extremely skeptical of the constitutional basis of the health care law. Turns around, he asks the states, but, you know, if to regulate commerce, that must include promoting it, right? And what's better than promoting, you know, what they're doing with the healthcare mandate is like promoting the commercial aspects of healthcare. I mean, so it's difficult to tell exactly where people are going to turn out because, again, I mean, we're having 6 hours of argument about this over 3 days, which is an unprecedentedly large amount of time in the courtroom. Usually it's 1 hour per case. But think about the healthcare law itself was over 2,000 pages, right? 2,000 pages is a drop in the bucket compared to how much paperwork these justices probably have on their desks and have been going through in terms of the initial brief filings, all the friend of the court filings that there have happened. That's really where the arguments are being made. This opportunity that we're seeing right now in the courtroom is a chance for the justices to try to answer any gaping holes that they think there are in the arguments, also to see how strong these lawyers can make their case, because if they can poke holes in them, maybe it's not as strong. So it is something to be concerned about for the government that so many justices seem skeptical, including Kennedy, who's become the swing vote on that court. That's not good for them. They have to be worried about that. And, you know, this may turn out, if we see a decision in June, it's a reflection of Tuesday, a 5-4 decision against them, and then we'll see what happens. But, I mean, just to add one more point, I mean, there's many outside factors. As much as this has become, you know, a Tea Party versus not Tea Party or a Democrat versus Republican issue on the campaign trail, there's several other sides to this. There's people that, you know, don't think that this should be something that's adjudicated at all because of the question of whether or not it's a tax. There's people that are to the left of where the supporters of the government's health care law are who are saying this should be a single-payer system. If we just actually had a tax instead of a mandate, then we could run health care the way we run the public schools, and that this would not be a constitutional issue, which is true. It would be politically difficult. But there's all these things swirling around, the little snippets that we're hearing today of the sticking crux point. So it's difficult to say, yes, this is dead because of what happened today. It doesn't look good based on what happened today,
right. But
based on what happened today is a fraction of everything that they are considering in paper and in terms of just the practical arguments that they're going to be talking about with their clerks and writing out over the next few months.
As you say, we're looking way, way down the road, making assumptions that we probably can't make, but advocates would go for something more of a Canadian-style single-payer system, or another option could possibly be doing it at the state level, as we've seen happen in Massachusetts.
Right. I mean, these are all questions that I don't think any Democrat right now who's supported this bill wants to even consider answering, because it's just too testy and dangerous, and they don't want to cede any ground to the possibility that this healthcare law that they spent, you know, basically the first 2 years or the first year of the Obama administration's and most of his political capital working out and getting through Congress just to have it fall. If that happens, yeah, there's going to be a scramble in Washington, D.C. to try to figure out what should be done next, because nobody, you know, that worked hard on this wants to see it fully go away. But again, then that's a question that the Supreme Court's going to be addressing on Wednesday, which is that, you know, if the mandate falls, can the rest of the healthcare stay alive? Can you still say you cover regardless of pre-existing conditions? Can you still say you are covered up until age 26, kids as parents, if you don't have this individual universal healthcare mandate? That's a question, too, that may direct the way that the justices end up thinking about this. It's not over. We were talking about the worst question on Tuesday, the most sticking central issue. Like I said before, the central issue doesn't exist in a vacuum. And the Supreme Court is considering, it's one of four questions the Supreme Court is considering. So they've acknowledged, basically, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. And that's why it doesn't look good after Tuesday, but it's very hard to say definitively this is over. That you just can't.
So the ruling will be is expected before they close the session of the court, which will be in June. Means that you'd have a ruling right as campaign season is getting into full throat.
Before Nevada primaries.
Right. How do you see it being played? Let's assume that the justices strike down at least the central portion of this that requires people to buy health insurance. How would that play as a campaign issue? In the Dean Heller, Shelley Berkley.
It's a huge political boost to whoever wins. If they strike down the mandate of the health care law, Dean Heller will doubtless be, out there saying, I told you so, I'm so glad the Supreme Court supported me, I've been saying this from the get-go, this is why we need to get those Democrats out of Washington, because they'll try to do this to you again, even though it's wrong and it's unconstitutional. On the other side, you're going to hear Democrats saying basically the opposite. The Republicans tried to scare you, but look, the highest court in the land upheld it. There was never any question about the constitutionality. We're just trying to protect your health care the way we always have been. I mean, you can rewrite the script, basically, because we've heard all these lines. It's just that this decision, whichever way it comes down, assuming it comes down on the merits, right, and this court doesn't take some sort of an out and say, we don't want to rewrite it yet, which they can do. But if they make a decision on the merits, whichever way they go with this mandate question, it's going to be a windfall of a game-changing. It's just going to push the ball one way or the other across the line, and it's going to be really big for races in which, like the one we're seeing in Nevada, the Nevada Senate, the two candidates come down as about as starkly opposite on this issue as two people possibly can. So, it's difficult to, again, predict which one is going to have boost out of it, but it's going to be a boost for whoever ends up, being on the winning side.
You're listening to Las Vegas Sun Politics on KUNV. I'm Michael Squires. We're speaking with Karin Demirjian, the Las Vegas Sun's Washington correspondent. Karin, we were talking about Shelley Berkley there in relation to the health care law and the debate over that. The House Ethics Committee announced last week that it would continue its review of Congresswoman Berkley. The committee hasn't said exactly what it's reviewing, but the assumption is facts laid out in a New York Times piece, which looked at her work to secure funding for kidney treatment in southern Nevada, and her husband, Dr. Larry Lerner, is a nephrologist. I have to ask, given that polls have showed this race is very close for months and months, can Congresswoman Berkley recover from this kind of revelation, even though there's been no finding or anything, but just from this kind of cloud that it kicks up around her campaign?
It depends. The one thing that's potentially very good for her is that this has not yet risen to the level of an investigation. There's no indictment. They have not said we find these troubling allegations of guilt such that we need to further investigate. This is not yet sentence-level stuff at all. And, she's got another important date coming up this summer, which is, I believe, by early July. The House Ethics Committee is going to say whether or not it intends to actually pursue an ethics investigation against her, or if it's going to drop it because it doesn't find enough reason to, basically, based on the results of inquiry it's currently conducting. If that comes back, if they come back and they say, actually, it really, thanks for worrying Nevada Republicans and House Ethics, the Office of Commissioner of Ethics in the House, but we really don't think there's anything here that's worth investigating. Berkley is going to have, that's going to be great for Berkley because it will be, it's out there right now that she was labeled, in this most corrupt report by the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, which is the chief watchdog group. The New York Times articles are out there. Everybody else's articles are out there. If the House committee comes back and says, actually, nothing to go on here, that wipes her slate clean better than anything could have. But if they come back and they say, we're going to review you in the summer, that's not going to be good. So right now, just kind of like this, it's still actually just this looming shadow over her head. Come July 9th, one way or the other, again, it's going to be a summer of real kind of crux moments for Shelley Berkley. But come July 9th, it's depending on which way they go, that, yeah, it's not easy in a race this close to overcome an ethics inquiry. People have done it in the past, but again, in past cases, usually there's more of a gap in the polls, not, you know, within a percentage point and well within the margin of error. So it's not going to be easy if they don't come back with a favorable decision for her, if they decide to investigate her. But again, we can't know that until this summer, and then that, again, that will be very significant for Berkley's campaign either way.
You mentioned a report by CRU, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Mm-hmm. In the report, it said Representative Berkley used her position to support her husband's financial interests. In addition, her husband, while not a registered lobbyist, met with lawmakers to advocate for the interests of renal physicians and has been a member of the board overseeing a political action committee for renal physicians. Berkley's answer to that has been that there was the kind of treatment that was needed was not available in Southern Nevada, or at least not in the amount that was needed. And she, along with other members of the delegation, were doing what any representative should do in trying to meet these needs in their community. Do you think resonate? Obviously, it's a lot easier to go negative in these kinds of campaigns. But do you think she's going to be able to get that explanation out there?
I think she's been trying very hard. She's also even said, you know, she should have been more upfront about her personal, you know, her personal associations with this issue, but that even then it wouldn't have changed what she did because she did what everybody else in Nevada did. And frankly, that's her best cover. That, you know, if she was looking for these favors, so was John Porter, so was Heller, I believe, and that, you know, has been her argument all the way through, that how can it be me if everybody in the state delegation was working for it, which may convince the House Ethics Committee. It didn't convince CRU. CRU has mentioned her now in two reports, and the more recent one that came out, you know, put her in a very big pool of the majority of members of the House of Representatives, which the report said. But she did get this dishonorable mention, which put her in the, you know, bottom half of the top 19 most corrupt members of Congress. And even though, you know, it's a dishonorable mention, which is not as bad as like a direct finger point in the face. It's just, it was, it was what started this snowball rolling down a hill much more quickly than it had been just after the New York Times article, because shortly after that, I believe within the same day, Nevada Republicans had filed their initial complaint with the main office, which then transferred that over to the House Ethics Committee in February, and now it has risen to level of inquiry, which is not an investigation, but things seem to be proceeding stepwise through the pattern and the motions through which they would. It doesn't matter, unfortunately, in politics, and unfortunately for her, if they do get to the level of an investigation. As we've seen, people's political capital can get very, very adversely affected once there is an official investigation ongoing, regardless of whether they finish that investigation, regardless of whether the lawmaker is ever censured or punished. So if it gets to that point, like we were talking about, you know, a few minutes ago, if it gets to that point, it's not going to be an easy time for her. But it's not to that point yet, so, you know, she's going to continue making the case that she has been making since this first came up last September, and hopes that that convinces the public as well as the ethics commissioners, so that they don't push this forward to the point at which it becomes really, really serious.
One quick last question. We've seen Berkley's campaign be very aggressive on a couple of issues, going after Dean Heller for being a friend to big oil because of his support for tax breaks for oil, or at least the tax system that gives those out. And then on women's issues, the coverage for contraception that flared up recently. Do you expect your campaign to continue to be that aggressive and go after Heller on these kinds of issues, or do they take a different tack?
I don't think that they will go silent. We've been hearing from Berkeley less and less just because she's become a very managed candidate at this point. I mean, you know, that happens in elections. So we may not hear her going after these issues as publicly, as forcefully as she has been, because, of course, every time she makes a public appearance, she's susceptible to being asked questions about anything, including this ethics investigation. Or what we may see is her redoubling her efforts on these issues because she wants to make a lot of noise every place else but, you know, where it is that she's potentially having this very serious difficulty with the ethics matter. So, the last few days, she's been fairly laying low, which is not really surprising given the, you know, seriousness of what has happened already. But we will see in the next few weeks. I mean, Congress is headed towards a big, recess period that always coincides with Easter. It's prime campaign season for people who have big, big, big races coming up. So if she's nowhere to be heard from, we won't know this year's election. If she's everywhere out there punching, you know, the Heller bag with more gusto than she was before, we'll know that she is trying to make sure that she controls as much of the message on every other topic as she possibly can, and hopefully fills the airwaves, from her perspective, hopefully fills the airwaves with as much other noise that, you know, is that she thinks may work and maintain the interest of voters and hopefully the loyalty of voters for her. But, I mean, we haven't heard Heller himself make a lot of noise about this because, you know, you don't want it to, probably because you don't want it to end up reflecting badly on you. Ethics allegations are bad enough on their own. But we will see how much this becomes part of the discussion on the campaign trail in the next few weeks when they head back to the campaign trail, and it's their time to react to everything that's happened.
We'll keep an eye on that. Karin Demirjian is the Sun's Washington correspondent. Karin, thank you.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Joe Shaneman, who covers Clark County government for The Sun. Joe, you've written recently that a looming fight over firefighters and officials, one that administrators are preparing for, will likely make them partners instead of foes. Like, you know, most people have been following this pretty closely. They've been at odds over sick leave, over their contract, any number of things, over whether they can raise money for charities on their while they're on the clock. So what is this that's bringing these two sides together?
Well, it's a fascinating development, Michael. It's actually almost 20 years ago, the good citizens of the county decided to tax themselves 5.2 cents per $100 of assessed home valuation, to support the fire department. Part of that money goes to capital improvements. The other part goes to operations. The vote is coming up again in 2 years, in 2014, in the fall. And based on the fear is that based on the current distaste, perhaps the taint that the firefighters union has developed over the last few years due to some of these unsavory news items, there are fears that the voters won't approve it again, and the fire department will see a potentially $15 million hole in their budget, which will cause all kinds of problems.
Now, you say this money is for capital and operation. This isn't actually paying the salaries that have gotten so much attention.
Well, you know, not directly, but if they don't have this money, then probably money that they're currently giving for salaries may have to come in to play to replace this. So, you know, I don't know. No, it's not directly, but it's helping the maintain their current salary structure, probably.
Right, and certainly in the minds of the public, money for the fire department.
I don't think that sort of separation, nuanced separation within a budget, means a lot to people who think the firefighters, the total earnings of the firefighters is out of whack. 2 years ago, it was $189,000 total compensation package. That includes benefits, as numerous firefighters email me and tell me. It's fallen to about $175,000 due to a decrease in the number of firefighters calling in sick.
So this will obviously be a campaign that the county will roll out, that I'm assuming the fire department will get behind, or firefighters union will get behind?
I don't know if there'll be a campaign. It's still, I mean, let's just say there's a general feeling that the public doesn't like firefighters or the fire union, as Tom Collins said. It's not the firefighters, it's the fire union. I don't know how many politicians are going to come out in some campaign with their arms around a firefighter with a big smile on their face, knowing that this is something the voters don't necessarily want to see. So I don't know how it would be done. I'm not sure about a campaign. I think they're going to have to figure something out, though.
Well, you quoted Steve Sisolak, the county commissioner, saying the gravy train has ended. He's talking about firefighter salaries here.
Yeah.
I hope people see that. Sisolak, of course, has made a name for himself by going after firefighters, at least what he sees as excesses or abuses in their use of sick leave and their compensation. Certainly a marked change in tone there. What do you attribute that to? Just
yeah, well,
that
I think that is, you know, that's without putting his arm around a firefighter and getting a photo op. That's sort of, to me, too, that was the
first. Riding on the front of one of those fire trucks like a Dalmatian?
Yeah, yeah, him with a fire hat on, a Dalmatian at his side, you know, smiling broadly down the streets in the firefighter parade or something. That, to me, that was his first olive branch. You know, he didn't say that's what it was, but it certainly did sound different. You're right.
So what happens now, then? This doesn't come up to 2014. They had a contract to work out.
They worked it out last week. Okay. I'm just saying, it was remarkably fast. It was much to the county's benefit. There's a two-year freeze on wages for firefighters, and future hires in the fire department will no longer get longevity pay, which is this old way of a benefit that was first instituted to sort of keep people from leaving the job. Well, nobody's leaving the job these days because there are no jobs. So they got rid of that for future hires, and they expect that'll save $60 million over the next, I can't remember how many years, over the next few decades. And that's really what the county wanted, to get rid of longevity for many, many years. Yeah. So, and that came together really quickly. I mean, that's a stroke in the union's favor.
Yeah, we should note that last time it went to arbitration, which is kind of the court of last resort, as they
The arbitration from 2010 was settled in 2011, but then the 2011 to 2012 contract also went pretty quickly. That was sealed up pretty fast too. This is the 2012 to 2013 contract.
And they're going, as a side note, they're getting one-year contracts. Why? Because of the condition of the economy?
Sorry. This is a three-year contract. This is the first long-term contract they've had in 3 years. So this is 2012 to 2015. I'm sorry.
And they have been using these shorter-term ones just because they didn't know what the economy was
going
to do.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Joe Shaneman, we'll keep an eye on this.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Joe Shaneman covers Clark County government, and Karin Demersian is the Sun's Washington correspondent. You can follow their coverage and the rest of the Sun Politics team at lasvegassun.com/politics. I'm Michael Squires. Enjoy your Wednesday.